We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey there. We at Blue Wire just wanted to take a second to thank you for listening to this podcast. We know everything outside is pretty scary and uncertain, but we're committed to helping you get through your day by talking about the sports and teams that you love most. If you're looking for more great podcasts to distract you, check out BlueWirePods.com. Thanks for listening. Enjoy the podcast and stay safe.
Hey there, welcome to Binge the Bucks, a special narrative podcast series focusing on the Milwaukee Bucks 2019 playoff run, part of the Eurostep podcast. I'm Ty Windisch, and I'm here with Rohan Kadi and our second Binge the Bucks special guest to break down Game 1 in the second series in the Bucks run in 2019, a 112-90 loss to the Boston Celtics. This podcast is brought to you by BetOnline.ag, and the Eurostep is proudly a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network. This game was rough. It's kind of hard to imagine now, and even looking back, but at the final buzzer of this game, it really felt like the Bucks were in a hopeless situation, ready to get sent home after a dominant regular season. To really capture the moment, we're sitting down with someone else who recorded a podcast directly after this game aired live. With you, actually, Rohan, a good friend, host of the Win in Six podcast, and site expert at Behind the Buck Pass, Adam McGee. Adam, welcome to the Eurostep.
It's great to be here. I believe this is my first time, although we weren't entirely sure.
I think that is correct, even though I misremembered one, but I think I was just, I don't know where I thought of that from.
So that's been a long time. So I have a couple of questions here.
Sure.
Are we all still friends? Are we, because invited me on for this episode. I thought I missed sports, and then I started to do preparation and watch sports to do this. And I'm like, you know what? Sports can stay away.
So I'll let Rohan answer for his side. I'm not gonna tell anyone if they're friends with Rohan or not. I'll leave that to Rohan. He has agency. But I hope are. I'll wait on your answer. That's usually, I think I've been the more friendly one out of the two of us, at least towards each other. But the reason I wanted you specifically for this game is I think you are one of the most realist Bucks coverage people, and I remember the particularly somber win in six right after this game that I listened to, that I, for a second I thought I was on just because I was so used to being on somber win in six episodes, I guess. But I wanted that perspective, and I wanted to really nail home how real and tough this loss was, and I knew you'd do well with it. So that's my complimenty positive spin on making you watch this game again.
That's fair. You're right, I'm wrong, because I think the realist part is right. That just comes from having been doing this podcasting, this blogging about the books for quite a long time. So I'm just over the kind of the highs and lows. It's just, it is what it is. But I did something else that I don't particularly enjoy in preparation, and I did re-listen to that episode that Rowan did join myself and Jordan Tresky for, and it wasn't actually that somber.
I will say, I thought I was very confident still.
No, you didn't. So
I didn't? Okay.
No, we'll maybe get to that later. I was going to say, some of us were more confident than others. Certainly the least confident was you, Rowan.
Awesome.
but there wasn't, we weren't in general panic. I think one of the things that we all agreed on was the Celtics, give them credit. They were really good, and they were probably about the best they could be. And I know, and I didn't know this going into my re-listen of my own podcast, but one of the few moments I enjoyed in doing that was hearing that I, in fact, said the Bucks would win 5 games. So,
ooh.
It didn't really do anything for me. I think it was as bad as the Bucks could be and as good as the Celtics could be. That was kind of my feeling at the time. It's certainly not the way you want to start a series. But I think that's ultimately how it played out. Like, you expect once in a series, you're going to get the other team's best shot on a night where you might not quite have it. And it just happened that the Bucks got that out of the way up front against the Celtics.
Did I say that the Bucks would win the series? Or was I just completely off the rails?
You said yes after a pause of about 15 to 20 seconds. You really were. You were rattled. You were shaking in your boots at the sight of these green jerseys.
Yeah, so, well, I'm sure as we'll discuss on this episode, I think I was sort of feeling like the problems that were sort of presented with this Boston team against Milwaukee specifically mm-hmm. came to light. And that was sort of like made my confidence waver a little bit.
One of the interesting things about rewatching this game, and we'll get into our quarter by quarter breakdown in a second. First, should mention at some point, I'll just do it right now. Both teams down a guard. I forgot how long Malcolm Brogdon was out in this playoff run. He does not come back for quite a while. It'll be a few weeks by our recording schedule, at least more than a week from now. And Marcus Smart is out for the Celtics for about, I think, the exact same amount of games, at least in terms of this series. I don't remember exactly when each of them got hurt during the regular season, but both teams down a pretty important guard, I think. I think people who don't watch a lot of Celtics might not think Marcus Smart is that important. I think especially this version of the team, based on how, shall we say, wishy-washy their chemistry could be. I think he provided a lot of very important things, but he does miss this game, as does Brogdon. I remember at the time, and I think this more came to light during the Raptors series, probably because there was just more losing to talk about, but I kind of remember thinking about, was it more the offense or more the defense? And I think this game, and a lot of the Bucks' struggles later in the postseason, I have my answer. But I'm curious, what do you two think? Would you, after rewatching this game, this loss, did the Bucks not play defense well enough, or did they not play offense well enough?
I think I honestly can't pick one or the other, because I think it was both were pretty bad. And I mean, we will get into this in more detail, but I think the overall conclusion to draw for this game, not to do it like 5 minutes in and just wrap up the podcast or anything, This was a catastrophically bad game from Giannis on both ends of the floor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if your best player, the best player in the series, is that off his game, yes, it's not going to be good. And I think, basically, the tone wasn't set for the Bucks on either side of the ball. Now, just by the makeup of their roster, if he's not playing well, I think maybe they have less room for error on the offensive end. But I don't think either thing was quite good in this game. I certainly wouldn't. I wouldn't compare my feeling of how this game played out or what went wrong here with what comes later and what the Bucks' ultimate end to their season was. I don't think we saw the same issues present from one to the other. I don't think necessarily the Raptors were able to say, okay, we're in a tough spot here. Let's look at the Celtics game one blueprint and go and apply that. I think this is, part of this is just on the Bucks not playing all that well. And part of it is also the Celtics just playing at a level where, you know, some of the things you got to tip your hat, like both Kyrie Irving and Al Horford were awesome. Like mm-hmm. really, really good. And for me, I'll be honest, there is a slight sense of relief in looking at this game and what the best version of that Celtics can be. And knowing that it all unraveled 4 games later, and that the Bucks won't have to worry about facing that group again, because, you know, they are they were good. They were really good. They had the potential to be great. They got in their own way with that. But I even think some of the, say, take Horford, for example, who I'm sure we'll talk about quite a lot more. Like, watching this game and it being less than a year ago, it makes me think about the season he's having now, and I'm like, yeah, he's not just completely done. He's obviously regressed in a major way, but it likely speaks to something about the team and the setting he's in now, as opposed to just how well that Celtics squad was set up in every way. Like, in theory, if Kyrie Irving wasn't Kyrie Irving, the teammate, they would have been a really kind of credible threat, and maybe the most credible threat to the Bucks for the foreseeable future, regardless of, you know, if Giannis signs a Supermax extension. So that was striking to me, was, you know, just how good and how, I guess, difficult a matchup the Celtics could be for the Bucks when it did click. Now, obviously, they weren't allowed to click and they got in their own way from that point on. But this was a very impressive performance from the Celtics.
Yeah, it was. You were seeing the experience of Boston, even though they didn't really have the chemistry, as you just mentioned. But they had the playoff experience. Like, Giannis and Chris, the two main players for the Bucks, they hadn't been to the second round before. This was their first time advancing in the playoffs, and they had a little bit of time to digest that, especially after like a sort of cakewalk through the first round. And then you have this team who went to Game 7 of the Eastern Conference Finals the year before without Kyrie and Gordon Hayward, which sort of made this team seem like a sleeping juggernaut, even though they struggled during the regular season. Like, the playoffs were their time to shine. They swept the Pacers, but it was sort of like a tough sweep. You know, like, thinking back, I didn't really realize that they swept the Pacers, because I thought at least Indiana got one game. But they didn't. So it was sort of like, it was a tough series for them, so they were already ready for, like, big battles, while the Bucks were just blowing out the Pistons in the first round. So you're sort of seeing that experience, that locked-inness. Like, it didn't last, as we'll get into later, like, in this podcast series through this series against Boston. But it's just, this first game, you kind of saw that this Celtics team was ready. Like, they were ready, and they were capable of doing real damage. Until they got in their own way.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't think Boston had a game plan necessarily that, you know, showed Toronto how to beat the Bucks later, as we'll get to in this podcast series. But I do think there were some things I noticed that did end up translating, and mostly on the offensive end. I think there's adjustments made, and we'll get into the quarter by quarter in just a second. But I do think that, you know, this is something Rohan and I have talked about a lot on the Eurostep. You know, the Bucks are a lot better than last year, even without Malcolm Brogdon. Obviously, we haven't watched him play in the playoffs yet in this series, but I think they just play so much smarter and so much better than they did last year. I mean, there's a lot of moments watching this where you just go, why does this keep happening? Why do these drives into a million guys keep happening? It is just as bad, maybe even worse than I remember. But we'll get there. Let's dive into the first quarter, which Boston does win 26-17. The series starts off right, very, very, very early on. A beautiful, tough Chris Middleton pull-up three is, I think, the first score in the game. Mm-hmm. But Al Horford, as you already mentioned, Adam, looking a lot younger than he has, you know, less than a year later, several months later. Rough block on Giannis earlier. There are going to be more of those later. And the Celtics just end up going on a run. And this quarter, some, like, I know you both mentioned kind of the peak of Boston. There's some ridiculous shot making. I mean, it's not even just Kyrie, like Marcus Morris, even Gordon Hayward is hitting like crazy floaters that don't look like good shots, but they're all going in, and Milwaukee's offense falters horribly. At one point, the Bucks are down 21-10 until George Hill, as he is wont to do, came through big time, at least make the quarter closer. But what were your guys' takeaways from this first quarter? What do you think happened to let Boston build up a lead to start game one that, of course, they would end up on top of the game? That was a weird sentence.
Well, when you, like, that Middleton three, you mentioned he hit his first two threes, I believe. He hit like two of the three first shots for the Bucks were Middleton threes, and he made both of them. And I just remember thinking, oh boy, it's happening again. He's just going to go off against the Celtics, and it's going to be beautiful because this team is actually organized. That fell apart real quickly. As like you said, Boston was just getting on a run. And What sort of stood out to me was Kyrie. He was hitting some tough shots. Like, he was working a lot down low and hitting, like, turnaround fades over Bledsoe, over George Hill, who are, like, elite defenders. And he was just like, if you're making those shots, you just have to shake his hand. Like, you can't do anything to stop that. And if he's making all of those while Giannis is getting shut down by Boston's elite defense at the time, you can't break that down.
I think for me, the standout from the first quarter is one particular play. I want to say it's probably about 2.5-3 minutes into the game, and the Celtics defense somewhat parts towards the perimeter, and the Bucks find an opening, and Giannis specifically finds an opening that says, okay, let's drive. And it's one of the first times in the game where that kind of opportunity arises. And by the time he gets to around the free throw line, Horford is there. He's willing to come meet him. He's certainly not going to get to the rim uncontested. But Horford, like, essentially lays down and is just like, here, take the shot. Take the shot. Giannis is just, say, 3 or 4 feet to the right of the free throw line. Honestly, a pretty simple mid-range shot, even where his game was last year. And he has no interest. He refuses it. And it's one of these moments for a lot of reasons where I think, in hindsight, knowing what happens, you can see the whole game fall apart. Because, I mean, the biggest issue for me with the offense is Giannis didn't have it going, and there was a lot of standing around. There was a lot of other, like, teammates static, standing in the corner. I'm in the corner, I'm where it's supposed to be, but not moving. Very, very easy for the Celtics to defend. And that was one of those moments where I think if he just steps in and takes that shot, make or miss, it could actually make a difference early on. Where instead he takes a mid-range shot from over on the left wing, probably around halfway through the quarter. But at that point, it's almost like he's already got to last resort. He's been rejected once, as you alluded to, Ty, of many times in the game by Horford. And at this point, he's like taking contested fadeaway mid-range jumpers where it's like, this is all I can get. So, I mean, the game was far from over in the first quarter. But I think there was elements of the writing on the wall for just decisions that I do think now Giannis in particular would, you know, react differently. Notably, he did talk about his big takeaway after the playoffs, and particularly after watching what Kawhi did to the Bucks, was, you know, he needed a mid-range game. He needed some go-to shot he could turn to. I wouldn't be surprised if this was one of the games he watched back and identified that, because, you know, you make some of those shots, or you even just take them, like proactively take them, step into them and take them, rather than being forced into them early on. And the whole dynamic of the game could have shifted for the Bucks offensively. But instead, they kind of, with that, they gave away the initiative early on, and their offense was being dictated to them by the Celtics rather than the other way around.
Yeah, it was sort of, we've talked about this a lot, but it's just how much better this Bucks team is in every respect this season compared to last season where the series took place. If you're playing this exact game against that Boston team this season, you would have Chris working to get a good shot, like in the mid-range, to just get a bucket. And you would have a lot more off-ball movement, as you mentioned, Adam. And it's just, you would have those other counters. But this team didn't really do that. They were just focused on getting to the rim and taking threes. And that's sort of what led to their downfall in this game, because you couldn't do that.
Yeah, it felt like tunnel vision to me, was what I kept thinking about. I mean, the play you described, Adam, is a perfect encapsulation, because even if, you know, I like that you went to, you know, what else Giannis could have done to score, but, you know, there were a lot of times across this game, and I'll come to more that I have in my notes later, but they'll be like, Giannis is under the rim, and like Al Horford is primary defending, Marcus Morris just constantly wandering away from whoever his assignment was in this game. Like, Marcus Morris ended up doubling Giannis a lot. I don't know how much of those were intentional, but that happened a lot. Sometimes there's even a third Celtic. So there's all these guys on the perimeter, and Giannis is just like, all right, how do I yam on five guys at once? And sometimes it does work, because Giannis is Giannis, where any mere mortal is going to go like 0 for 10 in those circumstances. Giannis is maybe making three, maybe four of them, because he is that good.
But you can't, you know, score a 2 on 3 or 4 out of 10 possessions in the playoffs and win a lot of games. And this was, I think, a good example of that. Giannis ends with, I think, just 2 assists in this game. Yep. 7 for 21 from the field. Only makes 4 shots within the arc. 3 for 5 from deep, which is funny watching this back because the way people talk about Giannis, it seems like he hadn't hit a single 3 in his life until, like, the Lakers game this regular season. But no, he was hitting 3s at least sometimes in some games. For a while now, people just kind of chose not
to
remember.
That's a whole nother conversation, Ty.
Yeah, well, it was striking because he's hitting big moment threes. And it's like he really kind of, like, the national, like, conversation is like, Giannis finally can hit a 3. And it's like, well, he was taking them, you know, years ago as well. Just nobody really paid attention.
I agree with that, but I do think, again, there's a crucial difference to that, which is he was taking those threes because, like, not just the Celtics wanted him to take them, they were forcing him to take them.
Yeah,
he had no other choice.
They were last resort trees, so there was no real impetus. There was no Giannis taking it upon himself, and you know what? I like my chances to make this tree, I'm going to take it. I mean, I think the 3 of 5 probably flatters him somewhat. I think the 22 points flattered him. This is, like, in terms of a big game where he played really poorly, this is right up there. I mean, obviously, some moments late in this series against the Raptors, and I guess the stakes of that also stick out. But in terms of just being, like, off, and you're right, the tunnel vision is a big part of it too. It went beyond them scoring. But this is the game where I think more than anything else, certainly more than, again, what comes later, I think, like, the books froze. This was the panic. This was something I don't think any of us have mentioned yet, but is worth pointing out. Like, this is the team they went 7 with the year before. So this first game has a little bit more to it. The teams know each other pretty well, but there's real cause for the Bucks to be just that bit extra motivated, and for the Celtics, and to be like, let's go and get this first game and make a point with it. And I don't know, the pressure of that really seemed to get to them. I don't know, both of you guys have done something I will never do, which is just rewatch all of the Pistons series. Like,
it was fun.
Do we really think upon reflection that was bad for the Bucks coming into this game? And both teams did have about a week-long layoff too, right? Heading into this first quarter, because they both swept.
Yep.
And then had to wait for the NBA, which is ridiculous. You know, both teams have swept to start the series. I really don't know. I think there was a lack of rhythm all around, but I think the Bucks, there was a real tangible sense of panic at some of those moments. I think there's only one quarter in the game where they free themselves up and they start to say, yeah, let's just play our game rather than playing the occasion or playing the moment.
Yeah, yeah, like we can get into that second quarter right now that you were alluding to, because it was just that was where they sort of realized, hey, we won 60 games during the regular season. We're a really good team. Nikola Mirotic decided that he realized that the goal is to put the ball in the basket instead of having a clank off the rim. So he forgot that later on. But he went 3 for 3 from deep in that quarter, and he sort of sparked a run that sort of, like, got Milwaukee back into this game. And it was nice to see, because it was just, like, what, a 2-point lead going into the halves, because Milwaukee had such a great second quarter. But this is sort of where they realized, like, oh, we don't need to panic. We just need to play our game.
Yeah, yeah, the second quarter the Bucks do win 33-26 that quarter to really make it a close game and going into halftime. Honestly, I didn't remember this game being close at halftime. I filed it away in my memory as, like, horrible, awful game with the Celtics roll. But no, this was a very, very contested game at halftime. It really did feel like the Bucks were in position to, you know, to take the home court back, make up for a bad first quarter. Some highlights for me from this quarter: Chris with that absolutely insane and one with about 5 minutes to go in the quarter. Just a beautiful grift on Jaylen Brown, and he somehow makes the shot. Love to see Chris grifting, because usually, I don't know what the actual percentage is, but it feels like about 50 to 60% of the time, if he draws an obvious BS foul, he somehow makes the shot too, which is just sweet. George Hill and Chris Middleton, two of the only guys generating offense outside from Brooke Lopez and, yes, Nikola Mirotic, making some threes. Chris makes a beautiful pull-up three to take the lead at one point in this quarter. It really felt like the Bucks were in position to take over this game, like I said. And then some more tough shots from Kyrie, which were happening a lot in this game. And Jaylen Brown absolutely spins Eric Bledsoe out of his shoes at one point. Although this was overall a pretty good Bledsoe game, which I also didn't remember. Or no, it wasn't. No, it wasn't.
No,
never
it
mind.
Not.
I'm thinking of thinking of game
the
two.
The first quarter was a little okay. The first quarter, he looked like he was, you know, present, not completely, you know, out of his body, out of the arena, just floating in space. But as the game went on,
yeah, no, this is what happens when you prep for games one and two at the same time. Bledsoe had a pretty solid game two. Did not have a good game one. I'm retracting that statement. That was a mistake. He's 1 for 5, the same as Brook Lopez, and slightly better than Sterling Brown, who was 1 for 7 in this game. But no, not a good Bledsoe game. What were your guys' second quarter thoughts, takeaways from this one, where the Bucks did at one point take the lead, make it a close game, but ultimately do go into halftime down a little bit?
I struggle to remember much of any of this, having watched it like an hour and a half ago, maybe, because I was just taken out of it by Mirotić. Like, this
is
the start of
jarring.
Mirotić's last stand. And, like, Mirotić feels like something that happened, like, 15 years ago, and that we all just wish hadn't happened. It's very difficult, this particular one, knowing what's to come and just knowing the sheer nothingness that... he offers going forward. And it's
hey,
like just
he made
something.
It, he made it a 22-point loss instead of a 30.
Yeah, I wonder, though, is this... I wonder about the impact, and this is some real, like, galaxy-brained, in retrospect stuff you can only do a year later. I wonder if him having a good game in this game ultimately doesn't play to the Bucks' advantage. I don't mean in the series, obviously, because they cruise beyond this, but I mean overall, because you end up making lineup changes and they end up playing small a lot more, and you've got Mirotić at the tree, and it's kind of, you know, no one likes it, but it's working, so let's just not say anything and keep going with it. Until the point where he just, like, starts to get shown up really badly defensively, and I kind of feel like that can't but hurt your confidence overall and probably eventually seep into how you feel when you're shooting. Like, it's probably a reach, but I am reaching. There's something about seeing him come out and being like, oh, he's actually kind of doing something good. Oh, that's interesting. That's strange. But also knowing what comes from there, I don't know if that was the best direction for the Bucks to kind of lean into. But then again, it's like you look at it and it's a very different story. I mean, the roster, the differences between last year's roster and this year's even. I guess most notably at this point, not having Dante. You know, you think of how your lineup options would have kind of evolved if they had Dante. But that is, for me, like, Mirotić being good is something that kind of took me out of large spells of this game, because we all know what happens next.
So are you saying that if he had, like, a bad game even earlier, like he didn't have this good game, sorry, he would have gotten, like, benched and taken out of the lineup earlier?
I don't think so, but I think the leash he was ultimately on would have been a little bit shorter down the road, and they maybe would have had to explore some different options. Now, I don't know, because the flip side of this coin is also, would that have led them to rushing Malcolm Brogdon back sooner, and would that have been even worse for what comes ahead? Look, we really can't answer that. But I do think, like, when they couldn't make any shots in the conference finals, we all know, you know, it really would have been helpful to have, like, just an average version of Nikola Mirotić, just career average version of that guy. The Bucks could have got to the finals if they had that. And I think by the point that they needed it, he had been played out of position, and, like, just some of those possessions and some of those games that you, both of you, will be reliving and you'll be able to speak to very specifically over the episodes ahead, there are moments that are incredibly ugly for him defensively, where you're just like, okay, it's fine, you know, they're getting past the Celtics and, you know, they're winning well, but I just don't know how that served Nikola Mirotić as an individual for the point of then next round of being like, oh, it's go time, we need you to do things against a good team. it was a weird fit overall. It was a move that I think we all understood and felt was worthwhile at the time. But it's even when you see him have a good game and trying to kind of pigeonhole him and the ways that it could work. Like Brook, I mean, this is kind of the story of Brook's time with the Bucks. The more time goes on. You mentioned he shot 1 of 5, which is correct. Like, he was a +2, though. You know?
Oh, yeah. I thought that was really interesting from this game.
But that's problematic for Mirotić because you're then having to play small or you're relying on him just when Giannis is off the floor. Like, that's where the fit of that. And then when you're playing him at the tree, sure, it can work. It can work from time to time, but boy, can it get ugly too. And we know it ultimately did.
I think a point with that is you didn't really have a lot of other options. Like, again, we've been saying how much better this year's team is. Like, you don't have a Marvin Williams you can throw in. You don't have a Robin Lopez to put in instead of Brook Lopez. You can't do that. You have to put Mirotić in because otherwise it's Ersan.
Well, yeah, because even Ersan, again, you're going to some of the variations of the jumbo lineups that Bud was partial to.
The jumbo lineups.
We all had a lot of fun with. Love them, but not quite in the configuration that they were necessarily coming about in the playoffs. And I think actually the best option, and this did play out, and he did not have a good game one, but I think is probably worth mentioning because maybe we'll end up overlooking him otherwise, is Pat Connaughton. Because Pat Connaughton comes in, he's at least active and he does a lot, and on this occasion that hurts the Bucks. But he kind of sets a template for something that becomes crucial going forward. Like, we talked about the lack of movement off the ball. Like, Connaughton's a great cutter and a relentless cutter, maybe more importantly. He will always look to kind of dive to the basket, give Giannis passing options. He will keep his defenders on on their toes. And on this occasion, it didn't happen for him. He was 2 of 10 from the field. But I was kind of, the minutes where he was in the game, I was kind of drawn to him because compared to a lot of the Bucks out there, he was really active and looking to make things happen. Now, if that's what you've got and Giannis is not his best, it's not ideal. But I do think in what was a bad game for him, he also kind of sows some of the seeds for the really positive series overall that he has against the Celtics.
I think what's wild about watching this is you don't realize how much better the Bucks have gotten. Not just in, I mean, there's things that we talk about a lot, especially on this pod, like how much better they play. You know, they have more counters to when teams will do what teams did to Giannis, you know, when they pack the paint or whatever. But just roster-wise, I mean, you guys are talking about the lack of options, really. And I think with Nico, I think especially against athletic teams, there's one position he can play, right? Like, it's the 4. Like, at 3, he's not fast enough. He's not a defensive 5. He can't do nearly the thing. He's not even close.
Imagine what Al Horford would have done to him, like, if the Bucks went, oh, we're just going to put him at the 5.
Also that. Yeah, like, that's awful as well. And, you know, against the Celtics team, there's not even really a 4. I mean, that's the Celtics team's DNA is, like, Al Horford. Sometimes they'll play with 2 bigs, sometimes. But otherwise, they're just, like, Kyrie, a bunch of wings, and Al Horford. So there's, like, nobody you can – I mean, even bad Gordon Hayward is, like, going to abuse Nikola Mirotić and did abuse Nikola Mirotić. So that's kind of, like – he's very Ersan-esque in that, and it's like I really only see one place to put him, and some teams no places. That's why, like Rohan, you pointed out Marvin Williams, but even like Wes Matthews can guard bigger guys capably, or at least he gives you another guy so you can move Chris and Giannis up. Dante for sure is one of those guys. You look at this roster.
It's the smaller options, like, and yeah. I think that's particularly what that stands out when you look at this. Rather than it being the Marvin Williams, which is good, and that's a different option in its own right. It's the fact that you're trying to kind of, you know, it's kind of square pegs around holes kind of thing you're trying to fill out. You've got good players, but I don't necessarily know if you've got the right mix, that the combinations were going to be seamless, and that ultimately did play out for them.
Yeah, I mean, you talked about Pat. Pat was 3rd in minutes played in this series. Like, he didn't start a single game, but total minutes, he was 3rd. Like, there were not a ton of options. I mean, Chris and Giannis are 1 and 2, then Pat. Eric Bledsoe, which, sometimes. Nico is 5, which, Brook Lopez is 6th, because sometimes there were some matchups that are questionable. Then George Hill, who obviously is very, very good in his minutes, but you don't want him to be one of your top guys. Then it's Ersan and Sterling. Malcolm only plays 1 game, and then you get the garbage time crew of, like, Tony Snell and Tim Frazier and DJ Wilson. Like, not a lot of great options there. This team was not super deep. Speaking of great options, with currently no NBA, NHL, or MLB on, you might think there's nothing to bet on, but you would be wrong. Our exclusive partner, BetOnline.ag, still has hundreds of sports, events, and games to wager on. Or you can let them bring Vegas right to you with their online casino and blackjack. This is all open 24 hours a day, and it's all completely online, including their $750,000 poker series. And if you're into props and entertainment betting, you can still bet on Survivor, Big Brother, American Idol, stock prices, and even the weather. Visit their website and join today to receive a 100% welcome bonus with your first deposit. Just use promo code BLUEWIRE. BetOnline.ag, your online wagering experts. Okay, we're past halftime. We've got to go to the third quarter now, which is, you know, the Bucks this past regular season, which may be over, maybe not. We don't really know. Anyway, they've been known for, like, really good third quarters. I think Coach Mike Budenholzer's done a great job of scheming for third quarters, making adjustments, everything else. That did not happen in this game. My notes, the third quarter from hell. This is the only quarter where Boston scores more than 26 points. Like I said, the Bucks' offense or defense doesn't really collapse in any of the other three quarters. I think they gave up 26, 26, and 24 in the first, second, and fourth quarter. This quarter, a little bit different. The Celtics shoot 71% from deep and 65% from the field, which is definitely not ideal. The pick and pops from Horford hurt. Horford's defense is very good. Maybe one of Horford's best quarters, I think, and it's probably his playoff career. What were your guys' third quarter takes from this game? They're probably not going to be super fun to go over.
Well, I mean, I mentioned at the top of the pod that it was sort of the fears of this series were sort of realized, and that was because, like, the big matchup problem coming in was Al Horford against Brook Lopez. Is Brook going to get played off the floor because of the pick and pop game and the drop scheme that Milwaukee was exclusively running? And that came to light. Like, Al Horford was pick and popping Brook Lopez off the floor, and then when Brook Lopez got off the floor, he was cooking Mirotić and Ilyasova. So Boston exclusively, like, almost exclusively, went to that in this quarter, and that led to Al Horford going 4-for-6 from the field, including 2-for-2 from deep. Like, if they're going to go to that specific exploit that they can use, that's how they won the quarter, because they found something that they can exploit. And they just went at it relentlessly.
Yeah, I think the book scheme is obviously more vulnerable to that particular approach. But, like, this should be, like, example A of how deadly the Kyrie Irving, Al Horford pick and roll was and could have been, you know, in terms of pairing those two guys. It was a real showcase of, I mean, what Horford does best has done for a long time. I mean, I don't have an issue with the Bucks overall sticking to so many of their key defensive principles. And I think even as the playoffs went along, at times when they tried to pivot, it didn't necessarily work. And there's a tough balancing act there. But I think Horford particularly, and I know in listening back to the podcast, the episode of Win and Six that we did, Ron, at the time, this was one of the key things we kind of focused on, which is just the know your personnel element of this. You know, this is fine. You can do this for player X, player Y, but not Al Horford, because the books were giving Al Horford his shots at his favorite spots. You know, you actually may have been better putting pressure on Al Horford and making him drive to the rim, you know, particularly when Brook is out there. So there's an element of that that is a little bit uncomfortable. I think part of that is, again, it's strange considering what Horford has looked like this year, but part of this is you've got to tip your hat. This was like an all-star duo playing really, really well and looking like perfect complements for each other together. But that is the thing from this quarter. I believe you might be able to confirm if you've these kind of things noted, Ty, but I also believe this is the quarter where Horford, I mean, Block would not quite sell he does to Giannis. I actually think in watching that, I don't think I've ever seen Giannis be blocked quite as, like, emphatically and forcefully as that in his entire career. It was a nasty block, a statement block, that really kind of speaks to just how dominant Horford was in this game.
Well, it was two in a row, right? Like, he kind of, he, like, stuffs him, and Giannis gets the ball back, and Giannis goes back up, and then Horford absolutely demolishes it. I think that's the play.
It's like a man throwing a child to the floor in the end. Like, yeah. You just don't see anyone do that to Giannis. It's very, very jarring to see.
The only thing I can think of that comes close is that Anthony Tolliver block last season.
Oh, God. what a deep cut.
You guys know what I'm talking about, right?
I do. It just sounds so funny to think about. Yeah, it does. Of all the players, I mean. I still think I'd go with the Horford one.
No, yeah, obviously. But it's just like, that's the only one that sort of comes close, because that Al Horford block was, it was insane. You're already dealing with a player in Giannis whose confidence was rattled in this game. He had no idea what he was doing. And then you throw that in there. I don't understand how that doesn't take a mental toll on him.
It might have been the dagger, honestly. Yeah.
Thinking about that too, trying to think of other players, like Jared Allen has got Giannis good over time, but it's when someone gets Giannis with blocks, it tends to be like a combination of someone who's really good at timing their blocks and also is using their length.
Mm-hmm.
This, you have both of those elements with Horford, but there's also just an extra layer of aggression that that's the thing that I can't quite pinpoint, someone just being able to like put him on the floor like that, because that's what we're used to Giannis doing to everyone else. So I think with the way this game was unfolding, even like we're talking about the impact it has for Giannis, for the Celtics, like talk about just a boost to kind of see you through that game. You can't have anything that's going to energize you more than that away in the Bucks arena, and their best players put on the floor like that, and Al Horford's having like one of the games of his career. That's a pretty big boost that, you know, is probably in hindsight difficult to overcome, regardless of some of the things the Bucks could have done better themselves.
And I think this was one of like the biggest tunnel vision examples of the game, because when you do run it back, Horford's there. Horford does all the work. But there are three Celtics right under the rim, and there's no Bucks around. And there's not enough movement, like you said before, Adam, astutely. But again, like after you get Bach the first time, you get the ball back. I mean, you have so many good shooters just posted up at the arc, and instead give Horford one of the got to be one of the most emphatic Horford blocks ever. Speaking of one of Al Horford's best games, I do have some trivia ready for you, Adam, a renowned Al Horford fan.
He's a personal friend, I like to think of him, but go on.
That too. Do you know how many times Al Horford... He scored 20 exactly in this game. Do you know how many times in his career Al Horford has scored 20 points in the playoffs?
This is one of these
slightly higher than I thought.
Okay, I thought the question was leading me and I was going to give something and you were like, oh, he's never done it. I'm like, what?
No. Certainly not that.
I don't know, this is a tough one, because his pec injuries came at the kind of times where the Hawks were really good, or getting better, and he missed some good playoffs. I'm going to go that he's done this 15 times? 20 times?
20 times.
Dang.
The fun part of the trivia is part two. Do you know how many of those 20 came against the Milwaukee Bucks?
Oh my God.
Oh. Six?
Seven. Pretty close. Ooh. Pretty good guesses. 7 of 20. So Al Horford percentage of playoff game 20-point performances against the Bucks actually higher than Nikola Mirotic's playoff 3-point percentage with the Milwaukee Bucks.
Awesome.
Al Horford 35%. two in this series, 2 of his 7 total, 2 of 20 total, 2 of 7 against the Bucks. Nico Mirotic shoots 28.9% in this postseason from three. So that's just some fun Al Horford stuff. When Al Horford has gone off in the playoffs, not more often than not, but I think more often than against any other team, the Bucks have been the ones on the other end of it.
That just made me so upset. You have no idea.
But he's a player who, for that reason, I think Bucks fans long coveted, because, you know, there was some logic too, if we were to go back a few years and center issues, or and you're trying to think who'd you pair with Giannis, you know, kind of a not washed up version of Al Horford alongside Giannis would be really, really good and really, really fun. But he was also a player dating back to his time with the Hawks who, you know, has done more than his fair share of damage to the Bucks over the years.
Can you imagine instead of Robin Lopez this season it was Al Horford?
Oh. That would be fun. That's a lot of centers, but that would still be a lot of fun.
I think the best version of the Bucks, like hypothetical, I mean, if you're going back, if say they could have got Horford instead of Brook Lopez at that time, I think a lot of people would probably be surprised, say last year, just how much of what Brook does Horford would have been able to do, and how much more beyond that. Like, he's a really fascinating player in terms of, I think, how he'd fit alongside Giannis. Now, obviously, we're at a point in his career where all this is kind of a moot point, but particularly that, and then obviously Bud's relationship with him too. And that's an interesting wrinkle for me in this game. Like, for all of the talk about Bud and adjustments over the years, and I am very much a devout and devoted Bud fan, and people will know this, and I don't think I go out of my way to defend him, but I do have more faith in him than probably some other people, even in the tougher moments, because I've been watching his teams, like, since he's a head coach. I've been watching them constantly through that time, and the fact, when we're talking about, like, the shots that Horford was allowed to take, the fact that Bud, of all people, was allowing him to take that is quite something, and is interesting.
I didn't even
to me.
Think maybe about that.
Maybe that is the one thing, because, like, Bud knows exactly the spots they're giving up and how they are Horford spots, like, just at the free throw line, kind of right baseline. These are his favorite spots. He is automatic. Like, they're like layups. Unlike any other big, maybe, of the last kind of 10, 15 years, and the Bucks let him have those shots over and over again this game. Which, I don't know, it might be something, even as both of you continue to watch through the series, keep an eye on, just how that progresses in terms of the games ahead. I know the Bucks didn't completely pivot away, but I've got to think they gave a little bit more attention to that, because Bud knew that well, and then they got burned by it anyway.
Yeah, one thing I didn't really understand about this game particularly, compared to, like, let's say this season, was how deep they dropped. Because they were, like, if you had a pick and roll at the top of the arc, like, Brook was dropping, like, halfway into the paint. And so was, like, Giannis on, like, every pick and roll. It was insane. Like, this season, they're dropping a little higher. I just did not understand how they thought that would work against this team.
I wonder, was part of that hoping the wrong guys will start taking more than their fair share of shots, if you get me? Like, that Marcus Morris will see that, and he'll be the one taking all the shots suddenly.
Yeah, that's fair. There was one possession I remember where Giannis, like, sort of dropped near the rim as Marcus Morris was spotting up for a three, and Giannis didn't even come out to contest because he was at the rim. And Marcus Morris made the three because it was wide open because of this, mm-hmm. just how far they were dropping.
Yeah, I think for sure there were some slight adjustments made from this game, and then this year, like we've said, in so many ways, the Bucks have been so much better this year. It's good to keep in mind that this was, you know, year one of the Bud Bucks. I mean, there were a lot of things still being worked on, still being ironed out. I mean, there were so many new additions and wrinkles. I mean, this team was actually doing coherent stuff based on what their coaches were saying for the first time in a very long time, so I think that played into a lot of this as well.
Frazier got 3 minutes in this game.
Yeah, headband sighting. Headband means the game's over, one way or the other. That's one thing, like, I've learned from this. When you see that headband, one team or another has already won.
But just imagine this year, like, and look, hopefully we'll get to see them finish out, and we get to see what this year's book looked like in the playoffs. But there isn't a Tim Frazier to come in and get minutes. You know, there isn't. He's a fine, kind of capable, solid veteran journeyman role player. I don't know if I could put any more words together there. But, like, the Bucks are so far past that in terms of their depth, the quality of their bench this year.
It would have to be Thanasis, right?
Yeah, he is probably the guy. I mean, DJ's would be right up there with him for me. But I don't know, maybe there's even settings where just that makes more sense. The fact that he was, even with, I know Brogdon was injured, but he was active and he got any minutes regardless of the scenario. Like, that speaks to the difference between the Bucks team this year and the Bucks team last year alone.
Yeah. It's insane.
I think, like, all from 1 to 17, the Bucks all got a little bit better. Every single spot, I think, is better than it was last year. Shout out to Frank Mason and Cam Reynolds, who I think both probably would have played real minutes in this game were they on the Bucks and playoff eligible.
Cam Reynolds? Really? Cam Reynolds? Can Cam Reynolds play real minutes ever, Ty, for the Bucks?
Yeah.
This is the question.
Oh, I think so.
No, I don't mean can as in, like, you know, is he capable? I mean...
Oh, like, no, I'm saying, like, if you dropped them on this team somehow and they were, like, eligible and active, like, I think they would have gotten to play. Like, this team, this, like, instead of Tim Frazier, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Sorry, Tim Frazier.
I guess maybe. I'm still puzzled by Cam Reynolds' failure to log even a single second with the Bucks. I just don't know why they'd even do that to anyone. But that is a conversation for another day.
Yeah. But anyway, third quarter comes to an end soon. I mean, Kyrie's making more ridiculous shots. Pat C makes a big three, one of his two made shots. As you mentioned, Adam, brings the Bucks within 10. But Boston just rolling from this point. And that's kind of the story of the fourth quarter, too. Starts out with a Giannis three, which was nice. Boston only wins by 5, 24-19. This quarter, they win the game a lot overall, or by a lot overall. Pat C dribbling is just something that usually troubles me. It did in this game. He gets picked off by Jaylen at one point. But luckily, Jaylen Brown throws it right to Giannis, who slams it. Giannis hits some more threes, like you said, really more desperation
stuff. I've never seen Giannis pad his stats, but that's sort of what happened in the fourth.
Yeah. This fourth quarter, I think,
don't know if he was
almost
trying to
junk.
Necessarily pad his stats, but that's what it felt like.
Because
if it wasn't for
like threes, it was over.
Yeah, like he had 9 of his 22 points in the fourth quarter, and it was essentially all garbage time.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. I don't know. Like it was pretty junk. I mean, as you already mentioned, we got a Tim Frazier sighting. Did anything else in the fourth quarter jump out to you guys?
I mean, we're on a podcast, so I probably shouldn't just say no, but...
Sterling gets hurt. That's one thing. I'd forgotten
yeah,
that.
I guess
Sterling
that
gets banged up.
Yeah, back spasms, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's ultimately what leads to what I was talking about earlier, that, Mirotić had some good moments. He made some shots. Sterling goes down. Okay. Go on.
One of the worst bits of defense I've ever seen in my entire life. The Celtics run a Kyrie Irving, Jaylen Brown pick and roll, which has to have happened like, or it ended up being a pick and pop, which had to have happened like, I don't know, 10 times total. That does not feel like something they went to a lot. But it's for somehow Mirotić ends up on Jaylen Brown, which is already a disaster. They try to like trap Kyrie Irving. I think it was like Bledsoe or somebody was guarding Kyrie. That part's not that important. They do like, Nico does like the worst trap I've ever seen, which is like, he just kind of backs up in front of him and everybody ignores Jaylen Brown and it's just the easiest three-pointer of all time. And you just watch that and go, yeah, that's about anytime Nico was involved on defense. That's about how it ended up looking. That's for sure.
Nico Mirotić plays defense like he played for Jason Kidd.
It's just kind of shuffle around a bit.
Yeah, just...
The Jabari special?
Yeah, move around, have active hands, see, like, make it seem like you're actually doing something when you...
Be tall.
Yeah, be tall.
Be tall is an important part.
Yeah.
He's just a really weird body type for an NBA defender. Like, I can't... Like, he's kind of... He's tall and he's lanky and you'd think he's maybe be a little bit quicker and a little... Like, you know what I mean? He's not Ersan where you're like, yeah, Ersan doesn't have foot speed because, like, looks at Ersan. Of course.
Yeah.
I mean... It's not like that, and yet, like, he just doesn't have anything defensively. Like, he's a good defensive rebounder because he's long. I mean, that was his only real value defensively is, okay, you put him in, if someone else boxes out, he'll secure the ball, which, it's a low bar. He was particularly good at it, but, I mean, it's a really, really tough one, and, I mean, that's ultimately, I mean, go get that money in Barcelona and live where you want to live. Because I think as he got older, you know, the NBA money would have dried up pretty quick because he's incredibly streaky. And there is just no answer to that defense that would have only got worse in time. It's just, I can't think of another player even around the NBA like him that I'd say, like, he's limited in that way defensively for that reason. He's kind of a weird mix of, okay, what is his body shape? What is his play style? And then what are the weaknesses? It just doesn't seem like it should add up, and it all kind of comes together to be, oh, there's not really anything good he does defensively.
Maybe Gallo? Is Gallo? Gallo's probably a little bit better.
He's a lot better.
He's just a better player, yeah. Too. So.
No, like defensively. Oh, okay. Obviously, he's much better offensively.
But that does factor into it because, you know, if Nico was better offensively, if he was Gallo offensively, you'd say, okay, well, he has no defense, but at least we can turn to this, where,
yeah,
like, that's the tricky part of it. Like, this is the kind of thing that I do find interesting with a player like that, and I've noted that all these guys are very self-aware, and they're kind of in kind of film sessions, and with their own kind of assistants that work with them, or personal trainers, this comes up, but... You know, this is an area where I do respect, like, Ersan's charge-taking and the fact that at some point he went, oh, I need to become a positional defender to have, like, a career at this level. I've got to really master that. And it's something that everyone can kind of do, is be like, you know, let's just try to learn the game, let's try to read the game and get myself in the right spot. So I'm not going to be worked over on my foot speed quite as often. And with someone like Mirotić, I kind of go... Just what if he had done that? If he had, say, Ersan's charge-taking ability, he's a completely different player, because you can live with some of the ups and downs of his offense much more, where instead you've just kind of got yikes when the shot's not going.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't know how you go through film sessions and just watch yourself get cooked possession after possession after possession and decide, I'm not going to change anything.
Well, I don't think
Nikola Mirotić has ever made a defensive stop in his entire life.
But I guess that's an awareness thing too, though. Maybe, and yeah, maybe I'm unfair. That's just some guys have that and some guys don't. Like, these are the kind of conversations we all had a lot more when Jabari was on the team. We were trying to figure out what Jabari would be. God. And maybe it does just come down to, like, not reading the game in the same way. In Jabari's case, that was always tougher because you're like, he clearly can read the game offensively. So then maybe it's just doesn't really care.
You don't get paid to play defense.
Yeah, I was about to get to that. So, I haven't heard Mirotić say something like that publicly, but maybe in private, that's one of his own favorite lines, too. Yeah,
what I'm gathering from this is that Nikola Mirotić is approaching Grievous Vasquez level in Bucks lore, if not already past it.
I would say past it, because I think, Grievous Vasquez would have been, like, at least a decent player. He just got hurt.
Yeah, at least, like, he wasn't an active negative, because he didn't play.
I can't believe I'm in this position where I'm going to have to talk with Grievous Vasquez again.
Yeah, I can't believe you did that to us, Rohan.
We're already
wallowing. Only Grievous Vasquez and I own Grievous Vasquez Milwaukee Bucks jersey.
Oh, my God.
Grievous Vasquez, very good player who, you know, could have helped the Bucks a lot at that time. Turns out was pretty catastrophically injured.
Yeah.
Not sure what was disclosed or not disclosed. And yeah, the book should not have paid all of that kind of price for him.
With Norm Powell and OG?
Let's not do the players who weren't drafted yet. This is
gonna
upset me
Adam enough. Yeah.
You know, the books. You're giving the books too much credit to say they would have picked the good players with the picks. You never do that.
That's fair.
Yeah, you know? pre John Horst, that would have been like long guys who existed. That was the MO of picks at that point. I think the Mirotić thing, though, just going back to that quickly. You know, that's the kind of the difference between regular season and playoff basketball, though. Like, how many teams over the 82-game regular season are, like, sitting there, like, how do we, you know, how can we take advantage of Nikola Mirotić? Like, it doesn't, I don't know if there's that much specific game planning. Like, you can be a not liability for the regular season most of the time just because, I don't know, it doesn't come up. And then in the playoffs, everything is so magnified. There's so much prep for each series, each individual game, that everything just looks so much bigger. And yeah, that was Nikola Mirotić not good at a lot of things besides shooting. And like you said, defensively,
was he good at shooting?
Not here.
Not for the Bucks. Nope. And that's
28.9%. Hey, he always has a second quarter of a 22-point loss.
That's true. That is true. This was one of his few
I can't believe that. I feel I'm to blame, but that this has turned into a kind of, you know, a pile on Mirotić. Considering some of the games you're going to do down the line, though, to be piling on him after this game, it doesn't bode well.
At least we're getting it out of the way. Hurt.
Oh, no, we'll get back to it. But anyway, that's this game. Let's do our series vibe quickly here in Ran Up. We went way over time, which is simply to be expected of an Adam McGee joint. Yeah,
Long-form podcaster, that's me.
It was bad. Things felt bad. I mean, like you guys said, the series wasn't over, but I do remember, like, the thought for me was, like, it's not over. This certainly was not ideal. It's very troubling. This could turn bad quickly. My whole thing was game 2. You cannot lose both of the first two home games. That feels completely impossible. I mean, it's not, but it feels completely impossible to come back from. where were you guys at on the series after this game in the moment, and then of course rewatching, you know what happens. But in retrospect, what do you think?
Well, I answer for Rowan, so he can only be honest.
go for it.
No, to be fair, your belief in the books wasn't true. I don't think you were picking them to come back as, you know, convincingly as they did, which is fair. That's a rational approach. I didn't take that. I was very much irrational. It worked out. I thought they'd win in five. It just, like, I think even rewatching it, considering all of the good books basketball we've watched over the past 18 months, it does just feel like, you know, this is like worst case scenario. This is as bad as it gets. And I think that was part of it for me at the time, was it's not going to happen like this again. You know, it's certainly not going to happen like this three more times against the same team in that series.
I love that you had to add "in that series."
Oh. Well, look, that's the reality of it. But I don't even... That's a conversation for a different day, and you guys will have that. But I don't think it's the same thing. I don't think the books played this bad at that time. I think there are other factors in it, and the main factor being, you know, they were playing the team that ultimately went on to win a championship, and the best player in all the playoffs they came up against, and, you know, those things certainly make life more difficult. But I think for this itself, it's certainly not a fun thing to go back and watch. I hope no one else listening has done that. I wouldn't wish it on anyone. I certainly, if someone invites you on a podcast under the premise of you should watch game one of Book Celtics again, you know, maybe don't do it. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, you know, that's fair. But, you know, we got a great conversation out of it.
We did.
Yes. But for me, overall, as a series, like you said, I wasn't sort of feeling like it was going to be as convincing. I guess I'm remembering now, because it's been proven to me that I'm a liar. But I wasn't going full Paul Pierce and saying it's over. But it was just, I wasn't as confident. Like, I thought that I was sort of feeding into the feeling like this team, like the Celtics team, was a perfect counter to the Bucks, and like game one proved that. So I wasn't as confident. One other thing I wanted to say about this series overall, Marv Albert not being able to tell the difference between Brooke Lopez and Nikola Mirotic was amazing, like the entire series.
Did he get Ersan in there too or not?
He might have. I just remember Brooke and Mirotic. He could not
Does
tell
the
difference.
Does he just see shapes and sizes? Is that how that works?
Yep. Colors. Yes. Clearly colors as well.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think one interesting element to kind of wrap up on this is, I think when you watch back on this, even though you know what happens, I could understand more easily now panic about this game than I would have been able to then, because we know what happens. I think this is still relatively a point where, you know, it's Bud's first season. They've won 60 games. Everything has gone right from this point. This is it. This is the only loss. Like, this is the only loss up until this point. It'll be their only loss for a while. There's no reason to completely panic about it. Where I think part of it is now, where if you rewatch, you're trying to pick out things of that kind of foreshadow what's to come, or that are tied into the concerns that people would still bring up, which I think in this series it doesn't, and in this game it just doesn't really apply. I think not enough can be said that, you know, Celtics, really good. Like, this was a really good Celtics performance, and Giannis in particular was just terrible for the Bucks. And I think kind of sinks the ship.
I think it's worth noting on like the kind of understanding the panic part of it, and this was something I kind of wasn't thinking of until right now. This was the Bud Bucks' first game against a real playoff opponent. I mean, sorry, Detroit Pistons, with like 1.6 games of Blake Griffin. It was the A seed. I mean, it was 1-8. Everybody knew what was going to happen there. Even the people, and there were and are plenty of them, who are Bucks detractors, who said the Bucks are frauds, whatever, regular season champs, whatever. You know, and everybody knew what was going to happen that series. That was the foregone conclusion. And it was a sweep, so everyone was right. This series was like you had mentioned earlier, I think, Adam, this was a very good Celtics team with star power, I think two All-Stars. I think Horford, this was probably what's going to be his last All-Star nod. And they were good, and the way that this happened, the fact that it was game one that they won so convincingly, there was certainly, you know, that doubt that I think every Bucks fan has in the back of their mind from watching the Bucks for the last 20 years before this, minus like three good years, it's like, oh no, it was all fake. It was fool's gold, etc. They're not really this good, whatever. And I'm not saying I thought all those things for sure, but those kind of thoughts, you can see how people got there. You can certainly see how people got there. I think it's definitely a little harsh. And of course, reactionary to do that based on 48 minutes and really just one really bad quarter. But you can see where it comes from for sure, based on rolling over a bad Pistons team, a playoff team, but not a good team. And then right away, when you see the real competition, this happens. It's just really bad timing, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it's also just, you know, people are always looking for reason to panic.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
Give people a reason to be mad or angry or panic or to be contrarian, particularly in social media, and, you know, they will take it. There's a certain subsection who are always waiting for that, who, I guess, lived their lives that way, waiting for things to go wrong. Bucks fans may be particularly attuned to that kind of mindset, just based on the years of what they'd seen. So something like that plays into it. But, yeah, it's this game, in the bigger picture, not a lot of fun, but no big deal. And you know what? Maybe a more important game going forward. Like, they didn't have to go through it in this way in the next series. But let's say this season resumes and we get a playoffs, and the Bucks in an important series lose game one at home. They've been there, they've done that, and they've come back with the best possible response. You know, teams do go through some things. This is one the Bucks went through and then kind of came back and passed with flying colors. So, not a big deal, but maybe a game that, even as we zoom further out, that if we were doing this 12 months down the line, 24 months down the line, we could actually look back and say, well, no, they learned something about themselves that day, and the way they lost was actually important for some of the things that came down the line. The fact that we only have one other series and there's so many other things, that kind of takes away from it. But maybe a series that in time, this Boston series and this game and the response to it becomes a little bit more interesting too.
Yeah, no, for sure. That's a great point. Do we have any other thoughts on this game?
I'm glad you brought up Paul Pierce, just to remind everyone that, I mean, I think really what changed the momentum of the series was probably Paul Pierce saying it's over. I think that was, more than any adjustment the Bucks could have made, that was probably the number one thing that swung this. No, that's all I've got, though. I think I'm taked out for game one.
Okay. Adam?
Oh, I'm done. I was done a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, in that case, we'd like to thank you for listening to this episode of the Eurostep. If you enjoyed the episode, please leave a rating and subscribe on your podcast platform of choice, and tell your family and friends about the show. Make sure you check out Adam, everything that Adam does, the Win in Six podcast, everything over at Behind the Bucks, the Caption on Celluloid podcast, talking about all things film, and anything else you want to plug, Adam?
No, you covered it all really well. Read my work and the rest of the team at Behind the Book Pass. Of course, Ty and Rowan are alumni of the site at this point. And yeah, Win in Six podcast. You can find myself and Jordan Tresky talking books, Captured in Celluloid, myself and Andrew Snyder talking movies. And at this current weird point in time, if you like my podcast, you like my articles, listen to them, click on them. The same applies to if you're a big fan of the Eurostep. Keep listening. We all more than ever appreciate kind of the interest shown in our work, and it makes a big difference at a pretty uncertain time.
I agree 100%. Make sure you check out all of the other podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. They're all great. They're all pushing out great content during this rough time. But I guess to wrap up, please stay safe, everyone, and we will talk to you next time.
It's happening daily. We're being conned by the institutions we used to trust. The mainstream media is distracting us with meaningless headlines instead of focusing on the harsh realities facing American families. Time is short before something big happens, and that's why so many folks are preparing. They're becoming self-reliant by investing in emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com and secure 4-week emergency food kits for each member of your family. Each kit contains tasty breakfasts, lunches, and dinners, averaging over 2,000 calories per day.
Save $50 on each four-week food kit you purchase. Plus, get free shipping on Ready Hour four-week emergency food kits. You're not ready if it's not Ready Hour foods. At My Patriot Supply, you can also get solar power generators, water filtration units, heirloom seeds, and survival gear. Order by 3 p.m., and your unmarked boxes ship the same day. Shop MyPatriotSupply.com today. MyPatriotSupply.com.